The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
For me, footwork has been something that's got me out of trouble on more than one occasion on and off the pitch, so I'll go with that one.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
Now, you're welcome along. Wednesday Night Rugby, we have a brilliant lineup for you. Andy Dunn is here in studio. Hello.
Hello, Joe.
And Ronan O'Gara, presumably somewhere in the south of France. Hello to you.
Hey, Joe. How are you? Hi, Andy.
Jeez, you look busy. You look like you've had a long day, Rog, and it's not over yet.
No. Not at all. No, we're on down week, so it's just getting the motor restarted. We'd all last week off, so we played Friday 10 days ago, so it's just a case of getting the boys in, getting a bit of exercise, because we play a post-Saturday week, so... yeah, never a dull moment in the top 14 marathon, but it's good fun.
Good man. Loads to talk about. We'll come to New Zealand in a second and some news on Razzie Erasmus in a moment. But Ronan, just to start with Keith Earls briefly, if we could. He was on with us yesterday, did an interview with us yesterday. He was genuinely exceptional. The interview received an absolutely phenomenal response, I would say. He talked about all things, including his bipolar diagnosis in 2013 and... gave a great account as well of getting on top of his mental health across 2016 and 17 and 18 and beyond, and proved to be inspirational, I think, and a lot of people really responded to it. Just to give you a sense of how open he was about things, for instance, here's a clip for you. So, you know, in the book, he talked about how school was very, very difficult for him, and he talked about skipping his biology leaving cert exam to go for a swim with his mates, you know, just really struggled to apply himself when it came to education and reading and writing, and he talked very openly about that situation. So just have a listen here.
You know, I kept three books for my three little girls, and I'm putting them away for them to read when they're older. But even writing, I wrote a little piece for the three of them last week, and I even spelled LMA's name wrong. I put E-A-L-L-A, you know, and she noticed it.
Right.
She said it to me. So, and even during the pandemic, trying to do the homework with them, like it was so embarrassing. And, you know, it is a tough thing to talk about, but I've accepted. I'm not frightened to ask, you know, how to spell something. I didn't know how to post a letter, you know, what way to write an address. Didn't know where to put the stamp. You know, he'd end up looking at me with two heads, you know, and, you know, my biggest thing there is, I suppose, was I wasn't frightened to ask for help. But, you know, I have embarrassed myself a couple of times throughout the years, and even more recently. And, you know, when Andy Farrell first took over, you know, the story in the book, he's asking me, what if I plans after rugby? And I said, look, I'm a small bit worried about it, because, you know, I don't read well. I don't write well. Like, I don't spell well. And, you know, he said he knew many people who went on to be successful. You know, you always go away and you try and learn, and you can pick it up fairly handy. But a couple of weeks later, we ended up having a spelling competition in camp, backs against forwards, and I was sitting on the front, and I was like, God, Simon, don't pick me.
Simon Easterby. Yeah.
You know, I knew I wasn't going to get up, and I wasn't going to be embarrassed, and lo and behold, he picks me. And, you know, I felt really vulnerable, and I was like, no, I'm not not stepping up.
And like, you're not allowed to say no in those moments.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the lads are all there, get up, Earlsy, and in fairness to Andy, he stood up, and he goes, he wasn't undermining me, but he was just like, Earlsy doesn't do spelling competitions, and that was it. And Simon even came up and apologized to me, but I said, look, you know, I've nearly accepted. Accepting has been a big part of my life.
Right.
And you know, how is he to know? But, you know, it is something I'm still struggling with, and I certainly have to get it looked at.
That's just a sense of how open he was in a range of subjects. To give you a briefer sense of some of the reaction in Peter, Keith Earls, brave on every front. Tracy Keneally, amazing interview. We have loved him, followed him. Never knew his struggles, a hero to many forever. Owen said, I always thought Keith Earls was just the strong, quiet type, but I know your pain, Keith, if you're reading this. It's reassuring to know a great man like yourself has demons too. Gregory. I can guarantee Keith here has helped so many people. Sea Dog, Keith, you're a credit to Moyross, Limerick, Munster, Ireland. Seriously brave and strong gent who's the epitome of Munster doggedness. Keep that chin up. And then one from Derek H, a last one, which is relevant to that clip. Great interview. I smiled when he spoke openly of misspelling his daughter's name. I hide it from work every day and have two amazing lads who help me with spelling. Now, Ronan, I know from reading the book, you two are incredibly tight. He's an extraordinary fella.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes a difference to a lot of the interviews that happen in sport nowadays. An incredible guy. Yeah, I don't think he was probably ever recognised in Munster camp that officially he went to the top of the room to say, you know, I'm suffering from bipolar. Maybe that language wasn't around in 2013.
He only did it last year with Munster.
Yeah, exactly. But I think a lot of the players, because players are incredibly selfish, obviously, and all they care about is their little world. And it was probably neglectful on us as players. Did we look after him as well as we could have? I think we probably did, Joe, but I think there were times definitely we knew he was suffering as senior players, as leaders, but I think there was also times when he was suffering probably with mood swings and down, and then he could have been extremely high at other times as well. I think it's a remarkable story of perseverance and mental resilience and his capacity to be, I suppose, hopefully one of the next guys to get to 100 caps is a massive testament to him and his family and his inner core of people who looked after him. But there was also, I think, times where he has a wicked sense of humour. I think a lot of Limerick people have that. Certainly the guys that I played with on the Munster team, they'd cut you in two with their sense of humour. And that was probably maybe his defence mechanism or his coping mechanism. But unbelievably popular in the dressing room. You know, I think there's exactly... No, Earls is not 34, is he? I think there's exactly 10 years between us. But it felt like 10 months when he was in the dressing room, because he got on, I think, you know what I mean, really well with people like John Hayes, who was quiet, but then he would also have an aura about him that he was very approachable by the younger players as well. So hugely popular. Was I aware over the years? I probably was, Joe, exactly. But I think it's only when you hear him there, it gives you goose pimples, kind of, I suppose, how much you care and the love you'd have for him as a player. But there's nothing more important than anyone's mental health, and it's a great message for people that are struggling out there, and the fact that, you know, I mean, these people chasing 500 points in their leaving cert or stuff like that, there's so many other different routes to get satisfaction in life, and Earlsey is a great example of it.
No, well said, and he sings your praises throughout the book as well. We will move on. There's so much to discuss. Some, relatively speaking, breaking news, Andy. Razzy Erasmus, on the back of his 62-minute video after the first test in Cape Town, which we're all very familiar with at this stage, this afternoon World Rugby have found him guilty on all six charges which were against him. So the punishment goes as follows. He is suspended from all rugby activity for 2 months. And he is suspended, maybe more significantly here, from all match day activities until 30th of September 2022. So effectively a year away from South African match days. And match day activity includes coaching, contact with match officials, any kind of media duties as well. And that will mean the water carrier duties are gone as well. Because initially on this UK tour, Jack Nienemar had said, oh, he won't be doing that anymore, the water carrying business anymore. And against Wales, he didn't. But against Scotland, the old water carrier bib was back on and he was doing it again. So we will not see Razzy Erasmus on match day until September 2022. That is a significant punishment.
Yeah, hard, it's a hardcore dish out. When I first heard the news about, 15, 20 minutes ago, I assumed it was one of these, you know, he's going to be banned for the next 2 months, as I initially read it. And I was like, well, there's no games in the next two months.
You therefore, Christmas
you know,
week.
Yeah, the busy Christmas week schedule for the Springboks. But no, it seems comprehensive. I think they have, and I welcome it, actually. I think he kind of very, very consciously tried to influence match day officials, which, and I think it was a new departure in rugby. And I think, ultimately, I think he kind of started to take the piss of it. And I think they've come down heavy on him. But I think it's an important moment, because otherwise you're going into a new departure in how people behave. Because as soon as somebody else gets wind of him getting away with it, they're going to start doing it. Can you imagine Eddie Jones and Gatland and the likes watching that, saying, well, they would like to say they took the moral high ground, or certainly Gatland would probably like to say that, but they're all similar characters. They're spiky, and as soon as he gets away with it, it's going to, you know, I think it's going to be a bad development for rugby. So I actually welcome it. I welcome how hardcore it seems to actually be. It's on the surface.
Stamp it out kind of effort, isn't it? To what extent do you think part of the length of the ban is because they also don't like his water bib business?
Quite a bit. I think it's a case of probably multiple infringements. And I think the last one, like the water bib type behaviour, has really irked them as well. I think they felt they needed to act. It had gone unchecked from the summer, really. So I'm surprised it's so strong and it's so comprehensive, to be honest.
Ronan, Razzie Erasmus, no match day activity until September 2022. Your thoughts?
Match day activity is probably, from a coaching point of view, is probably the role is probably overappreciated. All your work is nearly done. Depending on if you're a water carrier role, obviously it's not. But in the heat of battle, I wonder how many messages can actually be implemented successfully to players when they are in that situation. But like, in terms of your coaching week, once probably Thursday come, if you play on Saturday, it's over to the players and captains run day, and it's probably the night or the eve of the game, it's a little recap. Match day, it's players' time. So I think in regard to getting work done or work not getting covered off, that wouldn't be an issue really from a coaching point of view.
Okay. Well, it will be interesting to see his reaction. I suspect there may be an appeal of some kind. So that's just some breaking news.
It's probably important, Joe, too, to just highlight, I suppose, the importance of the protection for the referees. I think, as Andy has said, there's massive, I suppose, attention on that game, and especially on the referees are our role. It's precious enough in the game, and it's an incredibly difficult career or passion or whatever the word you is for attracting referees into the game. But you know, I mean, you're talking in the previous article about Keith Earls, but like, in terms of the ref mental health, he took an absolute hammering. And it was lucky for rugby in the fact that he was able, I suppose, to keep his wits about him and not do something that could have been awful, in the fact that you may come under such huge sustained public pressure from being attacked by a coach of the World Cup winning team. It's not easy for people to take that criticism.
Well, World Rugby have made it clear they don't want a repeat of that 64-minute video. So that's the Razzie Erasmus news. Ronan, I know our time with you is going to be slightly briefer than what we have with Andy. So let's start with you on Ireland 29, New Zealand 20. What did you make of that Irish performance? Brian O'Driscoll on Monday said it was the most complete Irish performance he's ever seen.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think it was because it happens very quickly, and we array so many good performances from the Irish team over the last number of years. But I think what was incredibly good was they didn't really get the breaking ball or the bounce of the ball and their capacity to go in at 10-5 and to absolutely, dominate for 40 minutes under a lot of mental stress because it would have been shattering to go in at 10-5 down considering, I suppose, the opportunities Ireland had and didn't take in the first half. But that showed like that they were able to kind of take restock at half time and build again and they won convincingly in the end. And it was a great victory for the squad. 23 players really contributed. Sometimes it's a team effort, but you could see in this performance all 23 probably had a big impact on the game. It was a victory for probably for line speed and for spacing. I think you look at New Zealand had two half opportunities. They took them. It was 14 points or maybe 12 points from two tries. But other than that, they didn't really have a sniff. But you could see their quality on two occasions. But I must say the quality of the New Zealand back play was very, very disappointing from my point of view.
Mm. Ireland with the ball in hand looked to be transformed from a year ago. What were they doing that was working so well?
I think their lines of running have improved immeasurably. I think their active pivots or whatever you call them behind the forwards, running decoys, attracting New Zealand defenders. You could also see too, I suppose, the big shift in the world game is that if ever there's an example of why man watching is over, you look at the defenders in black at the weekend and how many times they were taken by decoy runners. It's a massive advantage in the Northern Hemisphere. I think the coaching that happens for players who watch the ball, you have a huge advantage in the game nowadays. But so many times in the game at the weekend, you could see the players in black reverting to watching the man, and watching the man takes you out of the game, and Ireland destroyed him in attack in that regard. To answer your question, I think their timing of coming on to the pass, Gibson Park playing a tempo, Ireland's ruck was incredibly impressive. Players running at space as opposed to running into the chest of defenders, changing the point of attack. And there was times when Ireland ran into trouble a little bit because they lost their shape. But the amount of times, I suppose, Bundiaki carried on his own with a one-man clean, and Ireland moved the ball, it was incredibly impressive.
Mm. So this must... I'm not leading you into some kind of World Cup line here, but as a final point, this must give us all huge optimism all of a sudden for the next 12, 24 months for Irish rugby. And players first to say they have to back it up and consistency is important, but based on that level of performance now, this looks really promising for this Irish team.
I would disagree completely with you because I think this game on Sunday will be completely different because you're going to be up against a dogged, difficult Argentinian team. It's over, the game at the weekend, and that's what happens nowadays, Joe. It's parked, it's over. Like, the three test series in the summer will be completely different to playing in November. It's the flip side of what happens here. New Zealand come to Ireland at the end of a long season, particularly long season this time. Ireland will go to New Zealand at the end of a long campaign in June. So the roles are reversed. You look at even the major, I suppose, difference for me was New Zealand looked stale or jaded. Ireland were absolutely buzzing with energy. They celebrated every little mini victory throughout the 80 minutes, and they won the battle of the body language convincingly. Mm. Winning that, but there was 9 points with a penalty kicked in the last minute between the teams when Ireland played incredibly well, when New Zealand didn't play very well. So a fantastic performance. But I think when you're in the game, you kind of realise, well, that's over and I'm on to my next game now. And the Argentinian game will be different because now expectation is a little bit higher. there would be in a fear factor playing New Zealand. There won't be against Argentina, but Argentina will hit just as hard as the New Zealanders hit. It'll be a scrappy, difficult game, I imagine.
Okay. We got to let you go. Thanks so much.
Cheers, lads. Thank you. See ya.
Ron McGarra there, who made a bit of space for us there. Our rugby coverage is with thanks to Vodafone, sponsors of the Irish rugby team, Team Bus, everyone in. Andy Dunn waiting patiently. You heard Roger there. Things don't look positive. This is a low point for Irish rugby, Andy. I don't know about you. I'm not excited going forward. I take his point. Saturday is its own entity and has its own energy. But I'll put the same point to you. I would say based on the nature of that performance, things do look very positive all of a sudden. More positive than they looked 6, 7, 8 months ago.
Oh yeah, I think every reason to be positive. I really do. I think if you look at the fact we lost the first 2 Six Nations games back in early spring, that's been quite a rapid turnaround.
Did you see it coming?
I didn't see the English performance coming back in spring, and that was a huge shift in how we played. I suppose you're talking about what may have been happening in the background was there may have been a shift in how we were being coached, but that often takes time then to actually transpire and to, I mean, you're trying to develop skill sets. You firstly have to develop it on the training field, then they need to learn how to develop it under certain degrees of pressure, and then there's the white heat pressure of an international, and naturally enough that takes time to translate. But the English team, the English performance rather, was really struck me pleasantly by surprise. The Japanese first half, I felt a pretty comfortable sense that was Irish excellence as opposed to Japanese poor play. So yeah, I think putting it all together for 80 minutes against the All Blacks did surprise me in its how complete it was, but in a very pleasantly surprised way. I think there's huge scope for optimism. I would disagree with Raj there. I suppose if you're thinking like a player and you're in that squad, you've got to think that. You've got to park the match and get on with it. But if you're a supporter or you're watching that, For me, the case for being optimistic is that it's a game that is sustainable. In 2018, we beat them with this Herculean emotional effort. And while there was plenty of emotion on show against the All Blacks on Saturday, there was so much strategy and skill and smart, structured play along with creativity. When players are given license to play like that, it's sustainable. You're asking people to run at space. That's sustainable. I mentioned in the immediate post-match comments, if you ask a workhorse to run into a brick wall 10 times, they'll do it. At this level, these are courageous athletes and they're physically well-honed and they will run into a brick wall 10 times, but eventually they're going to get tired running into brick walls. If you ask the same people to run into a brick wall 3 times, but in the remaining 7 occasions out of 10, they get the ball, they're actually encouraged to make a pass, to look for space. That makes the game joyful to play for them. There's far more likelihood that the energy levels in the team are consistent. It's for anyone who's played the game, it's so much easier to attack space in a fluent way and maintain energy levels than it is to attack defenders and try and win them over through physical superiority.
And we saw Ireland maintain energy levels on Saturday.
Well, I think particularly, we all saw moments in the game where it ebbed and flowed, and particularly around that 60-minute mark. Or, for example, at half-time, at 10-5 down, it could easily have been a time for reflection or dejection, saying, "My God, how are we not winning?" But I think when you get a feel for the game, when you're in it, and you think, "Like, we're actually ripping these guys to shreds. We just haven't got there yet." That's it's different to going in and saying we've physically knocked the door down for 40 minutes and we haven't quite got there and we're 10-5 down. That's exhausting. I think there's, I don't know if I'm making that clear. Sorry, I think there's a, I think there's a difference in that.
You're like, making, you know, perfect sense. Yeah. Sorry, you're making absolutely perfect sense. What's striking as well, and you can elaborate on all this, is when I now see the likes of a Josh van der Vleer running off the ball carrier, I no longer feel like Josh van der Vleer is thinking about clearing it next ruck. I think he's thinking, I'm waiting for the pass out of the tackle. My hands, I'm ready to go here. Let's run. So the structure you mentioned is there, but once they make a break, I think they're really playing and going for it in a way maybe that they hadn't before. And the other point, you had often, it was a phrase that always stuck in my head. I thought it was a very interesting one. You had talked about the breakdown, and you said, if we look at that literally, it's almost a breakdown in play. It's a breakdown in our attacking play here. And maybe we need a couple of fewer breakdowns in our attacking play. So certainly against Japan, we saw far fewer breakdowns and rucks. And New Zealand, we were just chatting briefly before coming on air. I made this point to you. You were saying, well, we saw more against New Zealand, partly because New Zealand are so bloody good. Against other opposition, we would have had fewer breakdowns again. So talk to us about that whole psychological shift.
Well, it's there's a psychological effect of it, but I don't think the shift is technical. The shift is strategic. When I mentioned us playing a sustainable type of game against Japan in that 80-minute period, we're trying to keep the ball alive, we're trying to attack space. Typically, you have less rucks. Typically, as you mentioned, the likes of Josh van der Vleer as a support runner is actually, you're almost hoping he's running in anticipation of receiving a pass. And I think when we've really arrived is when you see Josh van der Vleer whizzing past, that the player can't quite get the ball away, but he's so up to receive the ball on a support line, the next guy has to resource the ruck. That's when you really know a team are going for broke and they're confident.
Van der Vleer's almost overrun the ball. He's so intent on getting it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's an area that I'd love to see further down the line, is players really making those runs in the hope they'll get that ball, because they will get it more often than not as the players become more skilled at releasing the ball in the tackle. Ultimately, the type of game we could play, and we did against England back in the spring, we only had about 78-80 rucks against England. Against Japan, we'd something similar. We're keeping the ball off the deck. There are less breakdowns, as you said. Is a breakdown in communication a good thing? Is a breakdown in your car a good thing? Why was a breakdown in rugby a good thing? So I think the mitigating circumstance against the All Blacks, they're so bloody good at their defensive scramble.
Yes.
That we did all the right things. We tried to keep the ball alive. We tried to attack space. Their scramble was so good, we still ended up having 130-odd rucks. But they were rucks on our terms that were less exhausting to win. They were fast rucks because we got behind them.
Yeah.
So Raj mentioned, Bundy Aki making a couple of single man, physical efforts, huge for him, but runs into their defence, but we were able to clear them out with a one-man ruck. You can only clear out with a one-man ruck effectively in international rugby is if you've already got in behind them and there's space.
Yes.
I think in the old days when I was critical of that Joe Schmidt approach from, say, 2017 on, we were having to win rucks with 2 to 3 people. It was exhausting. We were still having 130 breakdowns or rucks in a game, and that's not sustainable.
So a question I have for you, and by the way, when I said there a psychological shift, I meant a philosophical shift as opposed to, which is what we're seeing. So a question I've been thinking about the last couple of days then, and this weekend on Sunday will answer the question to an extent. Take Johnny Sexton out of this ecosystem. For the last number of years, Johnny knows his role, Johnny knows the opposition, Johnny knows the role of every Irish player on the pitch and is directing traffic in all sorts of ways and is fairly integral. Taking Johnny out of this now, this system, as opposed to the system of a couple of years ago, Johnny out of this system, is this more likely to work well or better than what we were doing before in his absence?
Yeah.
Or will it still be a huge loss?
Oh, no, I think taking Johnny out of any system is going to be a loss.
Sure.
If you look at his, to be fair to him, I think he's adaptable. He's shown he's adaptable to different systems. Taking Johnny out of the Joe Schmidt system was a car crash, because if there was a hierarchical structure, he called everything and the play revolved around him, and he was Joe's lieutenant on the pitch and it involved every kind of facet of play. If you're talking about prescribing multi-phase rugby, everyone knows where they ought to be. That's the antithesis. It's the total opposite of what we're talking about, Josh van der Vleer taking a gamble, running through, in the hope he'll get a pass. Because if he did that under the previous system, He'd be chopped. He would be chopped. And because his job was not to do that,
sure.
It was not to take that gamble. It was to get yourself set up for the third phase, like 13 seconds later.
Yes.
You know what X marks the spot. That's where you're meant to be.
Mm.
So if you take Johnny out of the current system, it's less impactful because not everybody has been told where they need to stand in every position. The responsibility is diluted in the out half row. So the likes of Joey Carberry, for example, I think he has more opportunity to flourish in this system. And I think it slightly dilutes, in a good way, it dilutes the seniority or the impact of Sexton's role.
Yes.
But I think Sexton can do it perfectly well too.
As he proved on Saturday. But
absolutely.
That reliance on one player is unhealthy.
Reliance in all sports, there's going to be reliance on top players. But I think...
Do you use the phrase car crash without him? And that's unhealthy.
Yeah, I think that is unhealthy. And I think in the previous system, it relied on somebody as strategic and as dogmatic and as demanding and as brilliant at times as he's been. You put in someone like Joey or Harry Byrne or Ross Byrne or
Jack
Cardier, whoever is the next person to line up, it's going to be very diminished, their impact. In the current system, far, far less so. I think it's far more fluid and it shares responsibility across the group. If you look at the amount of times we had a first receiver who wasn't Johnny against the All Blacks, I don't know the numbers, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was maybe more. We had more times a first receiver than Johnny, perhaps a front five.
And because there had been a discussion in advance of November about who's going to be the second playmaker. And I asked that question on air. And even as I asked
Tyke Furlong, but it looks a bit wrong.
Even as I asked it, I thought to myself, even this is very conservative. Who's going to be the second playmaker? Should we not have four or five playmakers out there?
Absolutely.
And so it doesn't actually matter who the second playmaker is. We should be talking about four, five, six playmakers. That's where we need to get to.
Yeah.
And to be fair, the coaching staff are driving that now.
Yeah, I would say that's where we've already gotten to. It was very clear to me how empowered the front five were, who typically won't be empowered to make dodgy, risky passes, but they did them. And they weren't dodgy or risky because they've been well trained at it. And they're comfortable and confident now to make that pass. We did a couple of passes as a front five player receiving the ball, I think 3 or 4 yards from our own try line at a ruck, and we made a little out the back door pass to a forward who is in space. The level, that's courageous.
Especially
and the skill level against New Zealand, because the risk of turnover, etc., etc. But ultimately, has a knock-on effect in the entire momentum of the game.
Craig Casey alongside Joey Carberry or Connor Murray alongside Joey Carberry?
Craig Casey, for me.
Figured you might say that, because it was tempo.
Yeah, and I think we know what... we're all very familiar with Connor and what he can do. I know it's not never a personal criticism. I've certainly been criticism of his overusage of the box kick. And I know that that's partially to do with coaching and what you've been asked to do. And it's partially to do with player responsibility. And I think players always have a choice to maybe change it up on the field. So I do think he's overused it. And I suppose I've been consistently critical of that. I would like to see Craig Casey. He's a similar style player to, or closer in style to Gibson Park. And again, if we're going to play this type of game, it would be nice to see himself and Carberry given a free run at it for 80 minutes. I think Conor Murray can also play this type of game. But I think I know that already.
Yes.
I'd like to see Craig Casey give it a shot.
One question I had, given that you were at the game and I'm sure watching him closely, was about James Lowe. Take away his amazing hit on Ioane. Great moment. Celebrated like it was a try. Everybody cheered and he said, well, I've been working on this and that's my D. Take that away for a second. General play, his decision making, because Ireland weren't under the cosh that much, and thinking of Six Nations and him biting in a few times when Ireland were under pressure. Did you see evidence there from general play away from that one big hit that his defensive decision making had improved, or is the jury still a touch out there?
I actually didn't see clear and obvious examples trade. I don't think he was questioned much,
yeah,
in because we had so much possession. We had 70-odd percent.
It's extraordinary territory. Yeah, because I thought, well, this will be the test. This will clear it up.
Yeah,
the debate. And no. Yeah, it's amazing it didn't.
I would say, next summer down in New Zealand, he's going to get questioned.
Sure.
A lot.
Yeah.
Defensively, and that would be a greater barometer. I think on Saturday, you'd probably have to say, the jury probably is still out on his defensive, not his defensive courage or anything, his defensive capabilities in terms of how he reads things consistently. But the defensive read that he made was game changing, you know.
And it was a good read.
It was superb.
Yeah.
It was really, really timely. I think they would have scored. I think it was, they showed how clinical they are and how skillful they are in 2 to 3 moments on Saturday, and that's all they needed. And I think that was going all the way the other end. So, yeah, I mean, a very good defensive read. He wasn't put under the cosh defensively for long periods.
So it's hard
to be definitive, I think.
He answered the questions he was asked, which is...
Yes, which is all he can do, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to make any last overarching point about the whole performance and where Ireland are, because you're often seeing things that others don't? Anything else that struck you?
Not particularly. I just really enjoyed the fact that it wasn't blunt force trauma for 80 minutes, which we've done before to beat them. This time it was a mix, physicality, exertion, all the rest, lots of spirit, lots of heart. But I think if we're going to be using eco-friendly buzzwords like sustainability, our carbon footprint's lower. It is, if you get what I mean. We're more, we're using up far less energy. If we play that way for the next couple of years, and I think that's the way they're hoping to play.
Yes.
I suspect things like we may even have a smaller injury count.
Yeah. You know? Well, that logic would, would be the logical conclusion. Mm. So we're phasing down coal, which is crucial.
Yes.
Andy Dunn, thank you.
Cheers, Joe.
Before we wrap up, by the way, we do want to send you to Ireland against Argentina this Sunday. We have a set of 3 tickets, all with thanks to our rugby partner Vodafone, to be in with a shout of winning. Just identify our mystery voice. Does not fancy the idea of another lockdown, especially if it means he can't meet up with noted crack merchant Nathan Murphy.
Come on, I need to go in and be able to have a pint with this man.
Who doesn't?
Come on, I need to go in and be able to have a pint with this man.
To enter, text your name and answer to 53106 for 30 cent and we'll ring you back after the show if you're the winner. Hashtag team of us. Thanks again to Andy Dunn and Ron Nagara.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.